Greetings to all of you this morning. We're going to be talking about sexuality, and what I had mainly in mind when I put these texts together was the history of marriage and celibacy in the church. Also, I think I'm going to need to say a word or two about homosexuality, because that's also a big issue, but somebody was joking, is this going to be a sex education class? I said, no, this is a church history class. So that's always a good excuse, right, when I can talk about church history. Let's look at these texts. First, Old Testament. Just very clearly, marriage, the rule. Some texts stand out for their sexual imagery. The two prophets, especially Hosea and Ezekiel, make strong use of the image of the unfaithful wife as a symbol of Israel's unfaithfulness. And then we have this Song of Solomon. I don't know if you've ever read it, but it's worth a read. It's kind of a surprise if you've never read it. As a matter of fact, some people think it got into the canon by accident, because they thought it was an allegory of love of God. But it's hard to read that and see it as an allegory of love of God. It is, it's rather erotic, actually. And this is Old Testament. Then the New Testament, the word sin is associated with the word flesh. So all through the New Testament, you can read the word flesh, I think especially in the Pauline literature. And it's important to understand what flesh means. In Greek, it's sarx, as in Romans 8:3, where we also have a neutral word for body, soma. But flesh, or sarx, is the root, understood as in the Greek, the way they use it in the New Testament. It's the root of all sinful desire, both sexual and non-sexual, as, for example, in the inordinate desire for wealth. It can be understood as selfishness, self-centeredness, self-focus in all possible ways. All right, texts having to do with celibacy and marriage and sins of the flesh in Mark. Famous text in Mark. And we see the parallels at the very end, Matthew and Luke, so it's well attested. And it's important to see the text follows the story of the rich young man who will not forsake his riches to follow Christ. Peter began to say to him, to Jesus, "Look, we have left everything and followed you." And Jesus said, "Truly, I tell you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother and father or children or fields for my sake and for the sake of the good news who will not receive them 100-fold now in this age, houses, brothers, sisters, and so forth." Well, this has been a text that, when it's been taken on face value and very literally, has through the ages been understood as a challenge to leave everything, to truly leave. So it figures into the monastic literature, for example, to leave. On the other hand, looking at the whole New Testament, especially the message of Jesus, he always says, again and again, seek first the kingdom of God, and all of these things will be added to you. Now, it's a matter of what is prior, what is first. Not a matter of abandoning your parents, leaving your wife, or whatever, abandoning your children. But actually, this text has been literally understood in the past. There were people in the Middle Ages who literally just took off and left their families. And there's an image of a wife standing on the porch waving goodbye to her husband who goes off to be a pilgrim. Maybe she was glad to say goodbye. She was glad to see him go. That's not said. But it has been understood in a literal sense. And we encounter, again, come back to this problem of the kinds of speech We see in the New Testament often what we call hyperbole. It's something that was common in New Testament times, not just the language of Jesus, but the language of Judaism at the time, where we see hyperbole. For example, easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. That's hyperbole. It's exaggerated to make a point. I think others, texts that we have become rather famous for being literally translated, like you will be able to handle snakes, poisonous snakes. Now that's hyperbole, right? That's not literally meant when we look at the way the New Testament reads. But there is a culture of literalism, especially in Protestant fundamentalism, that takes all these texts quite literally and becomes a serious problem. Karl Barth, for one, has very interesting discussions of the problem of reading the text literally, of what actually comes out. According to Barth's interpretation, is we become the manipulators of the text. That is to say, our reason becomes applied to it in such a way that we become the masters of the text in reading it literally. Instead of seeing the deeper meaning that is intended to be communicated by language such as you will be able to handle snakes, poisonous snakes, these hyperbole language. Well, passing on, Matthew, here's another one. This text has been taken literally, and by some early famous Christians, Matthew 19:12, there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by others, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Of course, a eunuch is a castrated male. Now, Origen, one of the great fathers of the church, as a young man, was having serious problems with his sexual desires. He kept seeing, I remember a professor making a joke of this in class back when I was in seminary, he kept seeing dancing girls in his dreams. So he decided to take the radical solution. He castrated himself. And the problem was he kept seeing dancing girls out. But again, that was a joke in class, and I shouldn't have shared that. But where you take these things literally, it wasn't meant literally. These are examples of hyperbole, exaggerated speech. Now, to make oneself eunuch for the kingdom of God, certainly we hear in this the idea of not being married, of being chaste. That's clearly there. It's not a command, but it is certainly there for the sake of the kingdom of heaven to dedicate oneself in that way. Now, if you look at the rest, you go to Galatians 5, works of the flesh. Again, we have that word flesh, root of sin, obvious. And this is important to see. For Paul, always, the problem of sin is obvious. Fornication, that is, not just occasional, sudden, once sex out marriage. This is excess. A problem where fornication is obvious, outside of marriage, and so forth. Impurity, which is an interesting word, seems to catch a lot. Licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, anger, quarrels, dissensions, factions, envy, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these. See, they're all very obvious. By contrast, the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Well, let me just compare right here what this text on homosexuality. There are three. I didn't print them. If you wanted to find them, you could just type it in on Google and you would get them. Romans 1:26, 27, 1 Corinthians 6, 9, and 10, and 1 Timothy 1:9-10. And that's where we find the word, usual word for homosexual, included as sinful. Now, the interesting thing is, I mean, word is obviously there. We can't make it vanish. But the interesting thing is it always is in that context of excess. Obvious excess. We're not talking about, there's no sense here of talking about a personal relationship. Two people who are of the same sex in a personally, what we usually call committed relationship. That's not what's there. Now, you could say, okay, but that's included. Well, okay, I couldn't say it's not. But certainly the sense is excess. Obvious excess. And it's interesting that in these texts, Luther, to this day, it stands in the Luther Bible. That is to say, Luther's translation of the New Testament. The two places where we find the word homosexual, or what's usually understood as homosexual, because there's a lot of disagreement about what exactly the word means. Scholars have been, especially for the last 20 years, 30 years, would say, have been discussing this at length with all kinds of discoveries about this word in the ancient world. But it's very interesting that Luther translates that word Knabenschändler, which means literally spoiler of boys. So it's focused on pedophilia. That's the way Luther interprets it. That's interesting. That's still there in the Bible the Lutherans use. The Luther Bible. It's still there. Knabenschändler, spoiler of boys. So it's interesting the way these texts then are translated. I'll say more about homosexuality as we go through the history, as we move a bit through it. Then Romans 13, this very, very famous and very important text on love. And just you read that, and you come to the last, in the third line, where all these commandments from the Ten Commandments are quoted, and then he goes on, and any other commandment, all are summed up in this word, love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. And then Romans 7, the reason I put that one in is that it applies constantly. It is in line with the Sermon on the Mount. It is in line what we find Jesus teaching in all the Gospels, Synoptics as well as John. It is the overriding commandment to love. And then God is love. So this is the overriding sense of all the ethics of the New Testament. Okay, Romans 7. Another famous text where Paul writes, I am of the flesh. I am sold into slavery unto sin. I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is my flesh. I can will what is right, but I can't do it. Who will rescue me from this body of death? Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. And the question is, what's his problem? People have often asked, you know, what problem did he have? And he says in a text, another text which I didn't quote, he says he has a thorn in the flesh, and he's prayed to God to take this thorn away from him. And he has heard God's answer, my grace is good enough for you. My grace is good enough for you. So the thorn is not removed. Well, there's a lot of speculation about what it was. What was Paul's problem? Well, maybe he was an epileptic. But maybe there was some other problem. Well, it does no good to speculate. It's just interesting that he talks about having a problem. Then you go to the next text. Romans 3, All have sinned, and all fall short of the glory of God, and they are now justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. Well, that includes all those people also that he talked about in terms of sin. The graciousness of God is extended to all. 1 Corinthians 7. This is a very famous text for celibacy. We start getting into texts that have to do with marriage and celibacy. And this one has a history in the history of celibacy. It is well for a man not to touch a woman. But because of cases of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. This I say by way of concession, not of command. I wish that all were as I myself am. But each has a particular gift from God, one having one kind and another a different kind. If you marry, you do not sin. Yet those who marry will experience distress in this life, and I would spare you that. I mean, brothers and sisters, the appointed time has gone short. From now on, let even those who have wives be as though they had none, for the present form of this world is passing away. And that last part is a very famous sign that Paul expects Christ's return very, very close, that it's very near. So the time is almost out. That's why he says, as if you had no wives. And so preparation for the end, I wish you were like me. You didn't have these kinds of relationships. You were just living for the immediate coming of Christ. That's the sense we have from that text. Then you go to Ephesians. Now, the rest of these texts, except for the last one, the Corinthians text 9:5, Ephesians and Timothy, we're pretty sure that these texts were not written directly by Paul. Now, there is dissent here. There are people who think that Ephesians was written by Paul at a later time. Timothy, the concession is generally no. This was a Pauline student who wrote the Timothy letters. But consider Ephesians. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as they love their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. Now, that's a very strong affirmation of marriage. I remember a professor one time saying, the best gift that a man can give his children is to love their mother. That's a nice saying, is it? The greatest gift that a man could give his children is to love their mother. I guess it's reversed too, right? But that's a very strong affirmation of marriage. Then you go to Timothy 3:2-4:12. Now a bishop must be above reproach, married only once. He must manage his own household well, keeping his children submissive and respectful. Let deacons be married only once, and let them manage their children and their households well. Well, we're going to see some interesting conversation in the early church about what it means to be married only once by the bishop. Now, at this point, bishop doesn't mean a bishop like we have them today. A bishop simply means shepherd. It's the New Testament word for shepherd, the shepherd of the flock. So it's the pastor of the local church. Now, let's jump again, 1 Timothy 4. Now the Spirit expressly says, now this is a very important text, that in later times some will renounce the faith by paying attention to deceitful spirits and teaching of demons. And here one of the things the demons teach is forbidding marriage. There is asceticism. And this is a sign of early Gnosticism. That's generally what we think today, early Gnosticism, this understanding of, we're going to come to that in the next paragraph, but a Gnostic heresy, teaching people not to marry, because the flesh of marriage is in itself evil. Okay, let's come to the next part. Well, 1 Corinthians. This is also an important text. 1 Corinthians 9:5. Do we not have the right to be accompanied by a believing wife, as do the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord, and Cephas? Now that Cephas, that is Greek for a rock, and it is the common word used in the New Testament for Peter, Simon Peter. And we find it in other texts, later texts in the church, that Peter was married. I just happened to check this in the Catholic Bible just to make sure, and it's there too, right? That Peter had a wife. We're going to get now, go into the post-New Testament period, and we see new things developing. Okay, prominent points of clerical celibacy in church history. The 3rd century AD and ongoing, and this we have emphasized in every session, monasticism, the influence of the monastic movement, moving out of the corruption of world. I can't emphasize this enough, and we read it constantly in the literature of the time. The church becomes popular, Constantine the emperor accepts the church, begins favoring it, building churches, putting money into the church. His mother is a famous Christian who goes to Palestine and starts finding all kinds of things having to do with Christianity. One of the things is, for example, the true cross. She finds the true cross. She locates the place in Bethlehem where Jesus was supposed to have been born. All of these things Constantine's mother has a great deal to do with. Of course, she's traveling around in as royalty, and she spends all the money she wants. There's no problem there. And everybody cooperates with her because they know who she is. So, the church opening the doors, but not without a deep awareness of the problem that they're losing their purity. With all of these people having to be catechized, they've got to be made Christians. I mean, we have stories of a Roman general, taking his troops down to the river and having them baptized. They don't know what's happening, right? Or only minimally do they understand it. The church has to absorb these people. So it's highly understandable that we get this counter movement, monasticism, moving out of the world. And initially it's individuals getting out by themselves. And soon we find communities forming. And then when we get into the Middle Ages, we have monasteries being formed. And then the whole history of monasticism in the Middle Ages. We see definitely how it happens. We see why it happens. We understand it. So this is by no means something that, at least for me in any way, evokes criticism. Why would say, oh, this is wrong, this is blah, 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 blah. I understand it. I think if I lived at that time, I would wonder what I would be. I wouldn't be a theology professor, would I? I would probably be, I don't know, either a priest in the church trying to deal with what it means to absorb these masses, or a monk pulling away, trying to preserve an original purity. But monastic culture isn't just simply Christian. There are complications in it. It's not the kingdom of God, right? Just because they go into the desert doesn't mean they find the kingdom of God. Yes?
Is there a relationship between the Essenes and monasticism?
There's talk about it, right? That even Gnosticism itself has Jewish roots. So it's unclear, but there are certainly possible connections. So if you were to read into it, you would read different things. Okay. All right, let's read further. The ideal of chastity, not only but especially for clergy, is expressed, for example, by St. Jerome in his tract against Jovinian, dates from 393. in which Jerome says marriage is only for the purpose of having children, sexuality itself is an aspect of fallen human nature and best avoided. Church leaders, if married, are to avoid conjugal relations, and this teaching is supported by decisions of the council, decisions of councils of the church in the 4th century, although marriage for priests is not prohibited. Now this is taking an interesting turn, because this is not exactly what the New Testament says. We see the New Testament texts. Of course, Luther, when we get to Luther, Luther will be reading, translating the New Testament, reading it in the original Greek, studying it very carefully. He sees these differences, differences that we can recognize in the text. Well, just pause a moment and say something about Jerome. Now, you can read this online against Jovinian. It is a remarkable read, because St. Jerome doesn't just think virginity is better. He thinks marriage is much, much worse. It all has to do with the inability to resist what he calls the fire of the flesh. He illustrates once with the story of Joseph and Potiphar's wife. You know, the story of Joseph is in the court of Pharaoh, and this wife of a high official is after him, trying to seduce him, and she grabs at him, and she gets his cloak, and he leaves his cloak behind as he runs out. And Jerome interprets that, that if he knew that if she had touched him, it was over. Because of the fire of the flesh, right? That's Jerome. Jerome's very, very strong opinions and points of view that he calls Christian. The Christian way, the ideal of virginity, is clearly better. And for those who can't, there's marriage. And it's true, he will say, we get children from marriage, but, you know, it's very, very complicated. I invite you to read it. It's online. You can read the whole thing. It's rather extensive. One of the things Jovinian says, by the way, the one he was writing against, Jovinian says, being married and being chaste, one is not better than the other for Christians. And that's what sends Jerome right up the wall. Of course there's a difference. Of course there's a difference. Well, next paragraph. Now this is debated too, the influence of Gnosticism on the early church. An important and influential heresy in the early church is Gnosticism, from the Greek word gnosis, knowledge, which here means knowledge of the way to God. It generally teaches that all things material are evil, and salvation means becoming purely spiritual. The body is the evil entrapment of a spiritual germ that must be released and cultivated by right knowledge. Christian Gnosticism is very widespread at the time. It is the most popular heresy of the time, Christian Gnosticism. In one popular form of Gnosticism, Jesus, as the Son of God, does not have a material body. He is purely spiritual. He only seems to be physical. He only seems to be a real human being. He only seems to suffer on the cross. He doesn't really suffer. He's purely spiritual. He is what we should be and will be if we follow the Gnostic way. Well, you see the relationship, similarity, between what Jerome is saying and what the Gnostics are saying. To be purely spiritual and to be separated as much as possible from the physical. Now this goes into the monastic tradition. Not Gnosticism directly, but the sense of the Gnostic. the clerical ideal, the ideal of the monk being completely chaste. Now, going to jump ahead to Luther, it's in your text. When we come to Luther, now this is, Luther's a monk. He's been a monk for many years by the time he makes the turn to Reformation. Well, just, you can turn over and take a look at that. It's on the next page. Martin Luther, based on his reading of the New Testament, declares the prohibition of marriage wrong. That is, we're talking about in the monastic life. Paul's teaching that some are given the gift of celibacy is not doubted. Luther does not doubt that. Some people are definitely given the gift of celibacy. Other people, the gift of marriage. He will say one is not better than the other. But celibacy should not be made a legal requirement for priests, as it was at the time. The decision for celibacy should be made only by mature adults and not imposed as an ideal on children or youth. Now, at the time, we have children being dedicated to monasteries quite young, to the monastic life, very young. We're talking about between 6 and 9, they could be dedicated to the monastic life and handed over for rearing to monasteries. Let's go back to where we were. The Catholic Reformation of the 11th and 12th centuries is led by popes. Remember, we've talked about this in every session, what happens in the 11th and 12th centuries, that we get out, the churches being pulled literally out of the Dark Ages by monks who are serious about the church, about the church's life. They actually, I think we call them heroes of the church for what they accomplish against the disintegration they were facing. The increasing power of kings, they establish clearly the power of the church over against the kings, but certainly it's not kingdom of God at all. Again, it's the first popes who call the first crusade and then the other crusades and saying God wills that we go spill all this blood, right, to recapture the Holy Land. But these are monks, extremely serious monks, led by, first line again, led by popes who follow the monastic ideal. They affirm clerical celibacy, now including the provision that the children of married priests may not inherit property. And then continuing in the year 1133, a major church council orders that priests are forbidden to marry. Both prohibitions are signs that many priests, for example, in rural villages, continued to be married. So it was an indication that there were priests who were married. Then, number three, with time, and this is rather famous, Hollywood makes sure that it's famous, the observation of this rule becomes ever more lax, and many clerics of the church, including popes, archbishops, and bishops, have mistresses and children. Now, there are some famous cases. Salzburg, Austria. Today, there's supposed to be a very, very fine house that's been made something like a national historic site. The house of a archbishop and cardinal. And the part of the story is very clearly there. The guy had 13 children. He was archbishop and cardinal at the height of the Renaissance. Well, so we know the popes. Popes did the same thing, had their mistresses and their children. Then we get in the middle of this kind of new corruption of the church, Martin Luther, who starts the Reformation. And Reformation has a great, great deal to to do with reading the text in the original Greek, reading the New Testament text. And in the Catholic Church, certainly the text was read, but what was more important than the text was the tradition of the Church in its decisions about what the life of the Church was, what the life of the priest was, and so forth. So what happens after the Protestant Reformation? The Council of Trent in 1563, which leads the Counter-Reformation, reaffirms its tradition, including celibacy for priests, and certainly also for monks. But, of course, the big issue for them is for the priests. Now, I should also say that we come back to the homosexuality issue. It's interesting to look at what happens in the history of the Church. Of course, we know Greco-Roman culture, that culture into which Christianity moved, as it moved into the world, was not hostile to homosexuality. Stories, indeed, customs in Rome where homosexual people, men or women, especially I think it's a tradition of men, would bind themselves in a quasi-legal way in a relationship of something like marriage. And this carries over into the early Middle Ages. Now, the Church doesn't change its mind. The Church has this very strict idea about celibacy, certainly for priests, and the tradition develops anti-homosexual. Well, in the early Middle Ages, this is no big issue. There are penances for it, for homosexual acts, but it's not extreme. Still, we see the effect of, again, monastic culture. When we get to this monastic reformation and afterwards, penalties for homosexuality become extreme. It's like it becomes this huge taboo. And then this feeds also into the Protestant tradition. Now, it's interesting, again, that Luther, when Luther sees those words, when he translates them, he doesn't translate just homosexuality. He says, Knabenschändler, spoiler boys, right? That's the way he looks at that word when he sees it in the New Testament. So we get a very interesting history. It's hard to come down and say, it's this, it's this, it's this. So somebody said, you know, John, you're going to teach sex education today? I said, no. I'm going to teach church history, right? And that's what I'm doing. I'm bringing you pretty much up to the present with problems, debates, and so forth, but I'm not teaching a sex education class. Okay. I just pause here and ask if you have questions. Yes. I think one of my, at the time, the first Protestants at the time of the Reformation who converted, right? They were mainly priests and monks. Priests, monks, and nuns. These were the first Protestants. So the one who performed the ceremony was a former priest, right? So the first Protestants are priests, monks, and nuns. Of course, Martin Luther, the monk, married a nun. It was a huge scandal. And right on up until recently, terrible things were said in the Catholic tradition about Martin Luther. And yet today, you can go into a Catholic church and sing "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," right? I was really shocked. In the past anyway, I like to go to a Catholic Mass because, frankly, often the Catholic Mass was a better sermon than what I heard in the church. The Mass is good. It's good. It is very rewarding to hear a Mass. It's a good, straightforward gospel, right? It is. I recommend it, especially when you can sing A Mighty Fortress Is Our God along with it, right? That makes it nice. But yes. That's a good point. The educated could read it. And of course, it was a challenge to debate. And this was what was common, to announce the theses for a debate. And that's what he was doing. So he was announcing a debate with the Catholic representatives of the church. Of course, at the time, he was Catholic. He had not yet broken. As a matter of fact, he won't ever really officially break. He'll get excommunicated. That's when the Reformation actually, Protestantism actually starts. It's when he's executed.
Who picked up the ball after the typical clergy and monastery got the feedback? Were there university people that picked up the ball?
Yes and no. Yes. Where Luther has a big influence in the universities, yes. But it's funny that merchants, the middle class picks it up very quickly. You need to clarify again.
Right. Were there other people like Josephus or anyone who made comments about Paul when he said that the Shakyamuni would be like me? Your first Corinthians?
Yeah. Yes, it's that's a monastic influence.
Okay.
That, you know, monks would refer back to Paul and say, this is the ideal, to be celibate like Paul. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. There again, as an historian, I must back off. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I do know that during the Middle Ages and afterwards, monks had a reputation for not being entirely celibate. That is to say, the common folk, would tell jokes about the cupidity of the monks, which seems to indicate homosexual behavior among the monks. So that's medieval stuff. Certainly in that age of the church when things are becoming very lax, bishops and archbishops and so forth, popes are having mistresses. So it's a time when this pre-Reformation period before Luther, the church is in trouble. The church really is in trouble. And Luther does a great deal to pull the church out of that difficulty, including the Catholic Counter-Reformation. I mean, there wouldn't have been a Counter-Reformation, an attempt to purify things again, had it not been for Luther. So we get a Catholic Reformation and a Protestant Reformation. So the Catholic Reformation following the Protestant Reformation. Yes, Ted?
In that historical context, is it ever seen as a problem that we're repudiating a creation of God?
Oh, sure. Yes. I think that's the sense, especially of that Timothy text. And in the Old Testament, there's no talk of celibacy at all. I mean, there are periods where you're supposed to withhold from conjugal relations for different reasons. But this is never a recommendation of celibacy. Right? You don't find that in the Old Testament. Yeah?
In Ephesians, where does the writer get off saying that Christ loved the church? There was no church when Christ was around. It was Paul that created the church.
I don't think I understand the question. Part of this has to do with my hearing, because this isn't great.
Well, say, husbands love your wives, just as Christ loved the church. There was no church when Christ loved the church.
Well, this is...
All created the church.
Yes, this is... Well, this is... one of the interesting discussions is when do we find the word literally church in the New Testament? Ecclesia. It's relatively late. So I'm not sure. I didn't check the Greek, but this word could be community. I don't know what the word is, but it's church here would be a legitimate translation of whatever it is. I should also say one thing I've missed. One of the things that has to do with the holiness of the priest, which contributes to the sense that the priest should be celibate, is that the priest is handling the elements of the communion. Now, throughout the Middle Ages, there's conflict about the nature of the Eucharist. Is there real presence? Is it when the priest says the words, do the bread and wine become body and blood of Christ, literally? Now, the theory is outwardly they look like bread and wine, but inwardly they are the real body and blood of Christ. Or is the meaning spiritual? Is there a spiritual presence of Christ? Now, this is a conflict throughout the Middle Ages. Augustine was one who represented the view of spiritual presence. Ambrose, one of his contemporaries and an archbishop, is very much a representative of the real transformation, transubstantiation of the elements. Now, with time, as we go on, the transubstantiation theory tends to win in the church and until we get to the Reformation when the whole discussion erupts again. But for the people, the way the people are taught, now this, the people, you understand, they can't read. One of the things we know is why the pictures around the walls of the church was so important was they taught people the story of Jesus. Pictures could teach what people couldn't read. And by the way, literacy takes a great jump forward with the Reformation. Luther makes a big point of getting people to read, to be able to read the Bible. But to come back, the holiness of the priest. I can't read, I only know what's told me. And one of the things I'm told is the real body and blood of Christ are here. Now, if the priest handles those and is able, with the grace of God, to perform the transubstantiation, then the priest is elevated just by that. And the sense of celibacy, of the priest not being involved in sexual relations, contributes to this sense of elevation. Now, it's interesting, you know, that was also true in paganism, in certain forms of paganism, also in the Germanic tribes. You have shamans, priests and so forth, who are holy in the sense that they withhold themselves from sexual relations, and that's part of their holiness, their elevation. So it's interesting that we find that, but it certainly it has to do, it's related to why priests, the sense of the need to have a celibate priesthood for the sake of the people. The awe of being before the elements of Christ, right? The real body and blood of Christ. It's interesting, there are all kinds of strange stories through the Middle Ages, like if it's really the body and blood of Christ, if it is truly the body and blood of Christ, then are we healed when we take it? Right? If you're sick, are you going to be healed by taking it? And another one is church finally decided that wasn't true, right? But they had to make a decision. And another one was if you take it a lot, are you going to be healthier, right? If you take the body and blood a lot, are you taking in healing? You know, and the more you take in, the more healing you get. That's something the church has to talk about, you know, to say, no, that's not right. So different things feed into this tradition of celibacy. Yeah.
I'm concerned about nature and the environment and when people begin within the church to be aware of nature. We have the Garden of Eden, and then we're kicked out, and then we have the world, which is evil. And the real world is the kingdom of heaven. So when did the church or whatever become aware of nature the way we think of it now? Protecting the earth, protecting...
Okay, thank you for going on to the next subject, which has to do with nature, right? If you read those texts on nature, you get a sense that already in the Bible there is a sense of destruction of nature. When? That's a very good question. I almost have to say in the modern period, the closer we get to the modern period. The Psalms are very clear. The nature, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God. All nature affirms this. The question is more, I guess, when do we fall into an objectification of nature that makes it distant and everything godly related about it is withdrawn? Now, I had some great science classes. I learned a great deal. And I certainly would never say one of my science teachers taught me to disregard nature. That's not true. But still, there is in our period an objectification of nature that makes it an object easily to be exploited.
In the world, but not
of it. In the world, not of it, yeah. But this, when I make the comparison, I've done a lot of reading in pre-Christian mythology. And if you've ever done any reading in that, you know that the Greeks especially, yeah, but it's in every pre-Christian religion, a kind of high valuation of nature. There's a kind of divinity involved in it. Plato thought the earth was a god. Plutarch, well, he has this on the moon. He's got a tract on the moon. And you know what he says about the moon? The moon is the place where people coming to be born pass through, and people going to their destination in heaven go through. And sometimes they wait there. And this moon has a kind of a magic, right? There is all around it a sense of magic. What are we going to do to the moon today? They're talking about going up and mining it. They're going to mine it, right? And I think I said to somebody recently, let them go mine Mars, but leave the moon alone. Thomas Mann, in his book on Joseph and his brothers, he has Joseph dancing before the moon, right? Sacred groves, you know, trees, sacred oaks, streams, nymphs, you know, related to streams. Greek myth is just full of this. The world is alive. Certainly also in a bad way. It's overdone. So Christianity comes along and says, these aren't gods. There are no gods here. There's only one God. And I have read philosophers who say, Christian philosophers who say, Christianity contributed to this modern objectification of nature by desacralizing the world, taking the aspect of sacred off of it. The gods who are involved in every aspect of nature. Well, of course, there were bad stuff here too. I mean, good, I've got the time to say it. I think a great illustration of bad sacral is the way the Romans and the Greeks too celebrated Venus. Venus was the goddess of, so to say, of pornography, the goddess of pornography. And the way they had pornography was on the stage. They would have plays, body plays, where sexual acts were performed on the stage. And a lot of it was comic. And it was said that Venus really appreciated all of this, right? She was the goddess of pornography. Well, you could say she still is. Look at what's happening, you know, on the internet and in a lot of ways in Hollywood. If it's not about vengeance, it's about sex, right? And usually, you know, my wife and I were laughing recently about Hallmark. Now, Hallmark, they're very nice, right? Very nice little Christmas stories we're getting. And you know, it always is, or often seems to be the case, that you have a widower or a widow with a child who encounters this wonderful new relationship. But of course, there's no marriage there before. It's a widow or a widower. So it's all very harmless and safe, but we find a new relationship. That's kind of the very soft way of celebrating Venus, isn't it? Because we've gotten rid of the marriage partner. We're into a new relationship, but we're taking the child with us. Pornography is just so easy to access. All you got to do is tap a couple of words in and you get it on the web. So why can't we talk about Venus today? She seems to be very alive, right? Celebrating these gods and goddesses who aren't just the gods and goddesses of pleasant nature, the moon, the earth as a god, but very bad way, excess. And I think this excess, this over the top, this behavior that's clearly excessive, is what Paul finally is talking about when he admonishes the Christian community not to follow these things, not to do these things, but to follow the way of the Spirit, which is to love. It's the way of the Sermon on the Mount. It's the way of the God is love. So it seems to me that those texts on sin in Paul have to do with excess. And that's what they saw in the culture around them. And that's where Christianity was supposed to be different. Well, any other questions? Or yes? Correct. That's very correct. It's true. That becomes an important decision on the part of this first monastic reformation, 11th, 12th century. I think they said that the children of priests could not inherit property. And that will continue. That will continue. But then they have counter problems with that. The other problem is, you have some parishes that are very wealthy. You know, you go in there, you're going to be nice. Things are going to be really nice. Other parishes are like bone dry. There's hardly anything. So what happens in the way the Middle Ages develop is people are paying money into the church to get the good parishes. So this becomes a matter of money. So it's not inherited, but we get into big amounts of money being spent to get prime posts. And then, of course, in the course of Middle Ages, only aristocrats become bishops. And we get monasteries that are purely for aristocrats. That's not the beginning. In the beginning, Benedict, when he starts the Benedictine movement, it's completely democratic. There's no regard for person, let us say, who's up and who's down, who's big, who's not. It's very, very democratic. We get into the High Middle Ages, aristocratic monasteries. I would say probably poor people in cloisters of nuns or monks almost did not exist because there was such an aristocratic effort, right? Matter. And the amount of money that gets poured into the church for the sake of wealth, above all, to get one's own soul and the souls of other people out of purgatory, out of hell, giving to the church becomes quite common. Well, other questions, sir? Yeah?
Indulgences.
Oh, you want to talk about indulgences. Sir. Okay. Indulgences at the time of the Reformation were almost the first thing Luther objected to. And it had to do with a policy on the part of the church to get money. An indulgence was paying money to get a document that said sins were forgiven. So you paid so much and you got so many sins forgiven, and you could write a name in. You could write your name in, you could write in the name of your son, your husband, or whatever, somebody you were worried about, right? You could write in the name. And Luther said this is clearly a misuse. But we know that St. Peter's Cathedral was built largely with money coming from other countries centered around the indulgence. Money was pouring in to the papacy through these indulgences. Now the catch was you were supposed to be contrite when you bought an indulgence. So it only went with contrition. But the common belief was, and the way it was traded, was okay, you give me the money, you get the indulgence, right? So this is one of the first things Luther objects to. Yeah.
I grew up as a Catholic, and I
excuse me, I did not.
You had to have grace to get into heaven, but the only way you can get that is through the sacraments, and they are administered by the priest. So the power of the priest to get you into heaven is pretty much part of my upbringing.
Yes. True. You had to have the sacraments, and of course you had to have all of them. Baptism, confirmation, right on up to your last rites. Right?
All of
them. Yeah. And I think if I were Catholic, and I know we have some present, I would not consider that bad. I think I would only consider it a problem when it becomes exclusive. It's like Protestantism, when Protestantism considers itself exclusively right. To the exclusion of everyone else. I think it's wrong. I would not say that. Like I say, I get a great deal out of a mass, attending a mass. Right? I think they are very good sermons. Right? And when I do this, I mean, there are Protestant ministers who do this. Right? Who will give the sign of the cross. And some of you know Lutheran services. You go, you can have the sense in a Lutheran service that you're in the Catholic Church. And that has to do with the way Lutherans understand the sacrament. They talk about real presence, something they've taken over as they understand it from the Catholic Church. And certainly Luther meant that. Luther says, when Christ says, this is my body, that's what he means. He means that, this is my body. So that's something that to this day separates Presbyterians and Lutherans. Because Presbyterians understand, like Methodists do and Baptists, spiritual presence, which they understand as real presence. Okay, I'm going to stop. Okay. Thank you.